I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next conversation is with Janet Dunnett. She's written a new book called The Dwindling, A Daughter's Caregiving Journey to the Edge of Life. This is an interview that you're going to want to hear. It's a book that you're absolutely going to want to read. This is not an academic piece. This is a story about healing. It's a story about caregiving. It's an intimate portrait of a family that was dealing with a pretty challenging thing that, according to StatsCan and to Janet's work, one in four Canadians are currently dealing with, and we're going to be dealing with it as a culture and as individuals, something that she refers to as the edge, or this idea of, she talks about it later on in the interview, but about having a senior strategy, which for her is really, I would say, rooted in this power of community and power of story. We talk about caregiving, and we talk about assisted dying to some degree. We talk about the guilt and the shame and the responsibility that kind of exists around this thing called assisted care. We talk about something called stages of life as go slow and no go. And Janet's has a wonderful way of finding meaning in something that's clearly so challenging and quite difficult. She talks about the death positive movement and how to end life well. We need to continue this conversation, and I need to continue this conversation with my family and with my friends. And so stay tuned. Coming right up, Janet Dunnett, and don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my speaking and my writing, and also facetofacelive.ca for more interviews about pretty much everything. So stay tuned. Coming right up, The Dwindling with Janet Dunnett.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today. Janet Dunnett is here to talk about her new book, The Dwindling, A Daughter's Caregiving Journey to the Edge of Life. Janet, thanks for your time today. I appreciate you joining me on Face to Face.
Great. It's wonderful to be here, Dave.
So it's a bit early for you to be doing kind of an in-depth interview. You're on the West Coast, are you not?
Yeah, I am on the West Coast. I'm looking out at a sort of cloudy day. Thank God it's been so hot, waiting for the deer to arrive. It's, it's early, but it's a beautiful day starting out.
Well, that's not a bad way to get out of bed in the morning, it seems to me. So first of all, I just want to say congratulations on the book, The Dwindling, and I'm hoping listeners are all already engaged with your subtitle, A Daughter's Caregiving Journey to the Edge of Life. Can you give us a little bit before we sort of dive in, a bit of an overview of the book and how you sort of stepped into this idea that there was power behind this story?
Well, the book is, as the title says, and I'll have to explain the title, I think, but it is a 10-year period where I was involved in, I call it an arc of caregiving.
Right.
It's not all the same intensity. but where the work I was being paid to do had to shift, and where my ideals for a gorgeous second career had to be set aside, and so on. It was that kind of period. And I'm an identical twin, and my twin sister and I have always been super, super connected, as twins often are.
Right.
And we came to the conclusion that this caregiving thing was going to happen and that we would do it together.
Okay.
So we did it. It went on. And when the caregiving was over, that was January 2011, there's a period of rumination and gratitude that it's over and let's get on with life and so on. But I have been a writer, not of full-length books, but of various kinds of
sure.
products. And so that itch to write it eventually became what Judy, my twin sister, said, oh, for God's sake, just do it.
right. Just get it done.
Just stop. Stop talking about it.
When you say, and, Janet, when you say this caregiving thing, you mean though in a very personal way. This is your family. This was your mom and dad. This is not you were doing this professionally.
No, the family caregiver is the labor of love, non-professional. And you know, there's a lot of us. There's 1 in 4 Canadians this year is doing family, what they call informal caregiving or family caregiving. 1 in 4.
Well.
And that means that whether they're a neighbor or a friend or a
right.
daughter or a spouse, something needs to happen for the cared for to get through the day.
And
they call that activities of daily living.
Activities of daily living. And so I have so many questions about all of this, and I've had a few guests on over the last couple of years, including a filmmaker, about, you know, talking about this end of life and the crisis and the ethics around it and just all the details and the love and the care and the concern, too, that really comes out of these conversations is quite remarkable. You say 1 in 4. I actually was surprised by that as I read the book. And by the way, I love the book. I love the way you tell it as a story. This is not an academic essay. This is very personal, very intimate. You really do peel back the layers in such a beautiful and relational way. So thanks for that. But 1 in 4 surprised me. I actually thought, wow, that's better. Those are higher numbers than I would have thought. You know,
I do a lot of
traveling with my work, and I get into other cultures. And when they found out that my father, my dad, who passed away a few years ago, he had Parkinson's forever, and so this is a really relevant conversation for me. When they found out that we had put, or my mom had decided to put my dad in this, you know, this place, this hospital, this care facility, this friend of mine, this dear friend and family of mine in Cambodia, they were horrified.
Yeah.
You know, they don't do that in their culture, and yet it sounds like 25% of Canadians are staying close to home.
Well, 25% of Canadians are not talking about it. And so when the household survey
right.
was done in whatever the year, 2012 or whatever, the Stats Can folks had to do a review of that because they didn't see that could be true. But it's true, and it's the same in the States and in Australia and in the UK. It's this demographic shift and this
right.
desire to be at home but I've got a story about this cultural thing. I was getting ready to be interviewed in Calgary, and as you may know, what happens first is you get a pre-interview with the producer, who in this case happened to be a second generation Chinese young man.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he started in on this, you know, in my culture, we don't,
right,
blah, blah,
right,
you know.
Right.
And I, at first, thought, oh, my God, this is going to be, sock it to the caregiver, or sock it to the Canadian. And it didn't happen that way, thank goodness. But afterwards, one of the people that I've engaged with around the book is a Chinese Canadian. And I sent her an email to ask for her thinking on that. And she came back and she said, well, two things. One, thank God there's still the young generation that thinks it's important to look after the older generation. Number two, it's a crock. Because as the Chinese culture comes into Canada or whatever, the reality is you you have to deal with caregiving in a different way than within the family. The mother is gone. She's working. And there aren't eight kids. There's two kids or 1.3 kids and all the rest of it. So I was relieved. I do start the book with a recollection of what it was like for my great-grandmother dying at home. And then I talk about what it was like for my mother looking after her mother, who's my grandmother, going out to work and ultimately having the boss at work say, well, you know, Betty, you're going to have to make up your mind. What is it that you want to do?
Right.
And she had to put my grandmother into care.
Mm,
and
right.
It was a terrible guilt, shame, taboo
wow,
for
right.
her. Which she carried. It's now 15 years later, and she's still weeping about it.
Is that right?
And,
wow.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the culture is shifting, and we hate that, but it's shifting.
Is it a relational reason that it's shifting? Is it a financial thing, or is it a bit of both? Are we becoming more concerned about our loved ones?
Well, it's shifting because the economics of Canada is shifting, and now you need the two incomes.
Right.
And you and that's a reality, not always, but
right,
generally,
right.
Woman goes out to work and loves to go out to work. Just as you were saying, David, it's kind of nice to go to an office and have people around. So that means that the person who was the designated caregiver in the old paradigm of care is happening within the family, she's not there anymore. And the system has gradually responded to that crunch by building more and more residential living.
Right.
And I think, we can be moved to think about different ways of thinking, if I can put it that
sure.
way. It's awkward. By a system that tells us what's good and what we should want and what we should believe in as important. And so the long-term care, residential care, assisted living or long-term care, has grown because we've needed it and because we've gradually come to a culture that says, yeah, darn good, that's
right,
the way to
right,
go.
Right. Tell me a little bit about the system. You refer to it as Goliath in the book. And I think somewhat affectionately, but maybe not always. So could you unpack that a little bit for us?
Well, in all the Western world and the developed countries, there is a system that would be probably called Goliath, of a bureaucracy that sets up very, very large around health services. And that's, what I meant in the book, and navigating all the disparate parts of the health services becomes what a big, big job of the caregiver is, especially at some stages, because nobody's talking to anybody. But the system is struggling to figure out the best way of handling the frail elderly person who has one or two or three chronic diseases, none of which is going to kill them, like a cancer or, heart failure, but which is going to remove an aspect of their capability to live a life without help. And so that system is having to put money into how are we going to do that. We don't want these people in a hospital, acute care, because it's so very expensive to do that. We can't put them in home care necessarily because the caregiver daughter has gone.
Right.
So what are we going to do in the middle? And that's what all about.
And you talk about the silver tsunami, and is the system in your mind, is it set up well to provide for what's coming?
No, not right now. And that's a lot of the reason why you write a book, you put the book away,
right.
And
it's why you become an advocate, right?
And it's why you become an advocate, because for sure the system is deer in the headlights around
right.
this demographic shift that's coming. I mean, by the time my grandson, who's two, is getting his driver's license or, you know, finishing high school, one in four Canadians is going to be over 65.
Right.
And at 65, you're still doing pretty well. But as my husband puts it, there's a period in that end stage of life, the go-go and then the go-slow and then the no-go.
Right.
And you're still go-go in 65, having a great time. But it's inevitable that you begin to lose capacity.
So it's go-go, go-slow, no-go?
Yeah. You get to be go slow, and you know your knees don't work, and you know you're breathless on a hill, and so on.
Yep.
And then ultimately, you just need help toileting or getting fed, and so on. And it is we've got this rich gift of longevity out of the medical miracle, but unfortunately, it hasn't kept up with.
Right, it's created other issues for sure as well. I'd love to talk a little bit about that. You do get into that that whole end of life conversation. I think near the end of the book, you talk a little bit about well-meaning physicians and what they might be hoping to do or offering to do, you know, to end a life. I'd love to chat about that, the ethics of it. But before we go there, can you sort of contextualize this a little bit for us personally? Your dad lived to 92, your mom lived to 88, I believe.
Yeah, she was worn out at 88.
Yeah, so were we no go?
Oh yeah. My father ultimately, you know, as I say, you have a number of chronic conditions. He would list them with great delight because he had that kind of sense of humor. But I think
and then all of the applicable medical treatments and medicines as well, right? He probably quoted it even down to the footnotes in medical journals.
No, he was that kind of a researcher, and
good for
you know
him, yeah.
Something's got to give you joy.
Of
so
course.
Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia might be fun.
That's right.
But
yes.
What finally got him was dementia.
Mm.
And that was in dementia. He fell and hit his head. He had a possibility of a brain bleed when he was sent into emergency. But he also had to do an advanced care, which is comfort care, meaning don't do anything radical.
Right.
The emergency said, well, I mean, if we can't operate on the guy, we can't do anything for him, so he's got to go back. So he was going back to his assisted living, which was his home. And my sister in Calgary phoned to say, we're on our way. And the assisted living facility said, oh, no, you're not. We're not taking him back because he's now too impaired for us to be able to handle that.
Wow, okay.
So, and in the book I talk about it, too, is this guy in the, departure lounge of the hospital in the middle of the coldest Calgary winter that ever was, shivering in a wheelchair, homeless. And that is a reality of assisted living is for the go-slow types, not the no-go type.
Right, right.
And how do they get rid of you? Well, they just don't take you back if you've had an ER visit. So his end was that brain bleed.
Right.
That wasn't taken care of, and you know who knows. Before you die, you don't know you're going to die. But 2 weeks later, he was gone.
Mm.
And my mother was more typical, but less typical in a way. She was absolutely cognitively 100% intact, but mostly sleeping. And she was paralyzed and blind and needed help with everything. And she had, again, a list of chronic conditions as long as your arm, none of which she was delighted about like my father was. But they did her in, and she suffered more than my father because she was this beautiful brain inside this paralyzed, almost semi-vegetative state for 2.5, 3 years.
Is this, and I would imagine this is what kind of fed into the title of the book for you. I mean, did you go through a long list of titles? Did you struggle with?
The titles went with where I was in
at the time, sort of.
Yeah.
Right.
Like. Dutiful Daughter was
right.
one that
okay.
was during my angry draft,
right.
and Right On was a title that was in the let's put a smiley face on all
sure.
of this
sure.
draft and so on, but ultimately Dwindling is the word that is the truthful word around what the medical person would call a multiple complex. Chronic conditions, frailty,
right.
advanced aging.
Right.
And in our world that we've been talking about, that's the way most of us are going to pass out of this world. 70% of us are going to die that way.
Wow. So
according to some of the statistics.
70% of us are going to dwindle.
Are going to dwindle, and they're going to need care for 2 years, 3 years. You know, more like what my mother, well, my father too. So forget this aneurysm on the 18th hole after a hole in one
right.
idea, or even forget this. Well, I'm just not going to stick around when things get hard. Idea, because mostly what's going to happen is that it's going to be a sort of a need creep through to
interesting
a very tough time, and then you're.
So
you're going to die of something that will surprise everybody.
It will surprise everybody. I absolutely want to talk a little bit too more about your sister and your husband as well, because you very intimately kind of portray that part of the challenge or those challenges that were raised. What has this done for you with respect to, you know, just thinking about death? I mean, you know, are we prepared? Do we talk about it enough? Should we be raising this more with our children? My son's at an age now where he's asking, and he's been asking them for years, but these, you know, pretty profound, deep philosophical, theological, cosmological questions, you know?
Right,
and so he'll every now and then, Dad, if you, you know, how would you like to die? You know, would you rather this or would you rather that? You
tell him about the aneurysm on the 18th.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, okay, I think I'd like to go in a surfing accident, you know, or, you know, something really kind of romantic, you know. But has it provided, it must have provided opportunities for you, even maybe post or during writing, to say, to have some pretty profound thoughts on you know, death and dying.
Yeah. Well, personally, yes. And as part of the advocacy that I'm doing, bigger yes.
Right.
And as the society is moving, I think biggest yes, because, you know, it we are the boomers and we're this huge demographic moving through. And,
right.
you know, when we needed primary schools, they were built. And when we needed birth control, we got it and so on through our lifespan. And now the first boomer turned 65 a few years ago. Now we're all the big, huge lump of us at the end.
Right.
And we're pretty well educated, and we're a pretty loud bunch.
Yep.
And so what's emerging is something, when I look at it, it's almost called a death positive movement in a way, that more mindful people are ready to come to grips with the fact that life
right.
ends and we have choices around that, and we should be thinking about that and telling our kids.
It's good. I was just going to say, so then you would clearly, I think, argue that the more we talk about it now, you know, in our, what would we say, the go slow phase, or maybe the go phase, that's going to allow us to, I don't know, provide a better quality of life and maybe more importantly, provide better care for others.
That's right.
At the end of life.
Yeah, we're all, as boomers, and my advocacy is, as boomers, we better speak up and look for a better deal, because we're next. We've been through
right.
what it looks like
right.
with our parents.
Sure.
And if you don't like what you see, well, what would you like? And let's work towards that.
Yeah, yeah. And just to sort of close that loop on that, cross-cultural commentary you were making earlier, your comment was really quite positive in the sense that, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but that that we are kind of globally getting better at this.
Yep. Yeah. It's never as fast as you like. Mm. You know, your desire is way ahead of the reality through a something so unwieldy as a Goliath.
Right.
But we, in my world, and I know I choose my world, I live in a little bubble like we all do. And in my little bubble, we have deaf cafes and we have you read this book? And
right.
we're looking at a growing body of literature about how to handle end of life existentially as well as in the practical matters.
Well, that's wonderful. Death cafes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds riveting.
Have you heard about those?
I haven't. No. Do you guys play shuffleboard or?
Doesn't sound. Well, it's meant like the title of my book to sort of hit you between the eyes.
That's right.
But it's a movement. It's a movement that started in the UK not so long ago, maybe within the last 10 years. And it is part of this death positive. Mm. We have to talk about it.
Right, right.
And it's good. Do something to peel away the taboo and the almost shame about it.
Yeah, right.
And right. So what happens is, all over the world, there's thousands of them. It's for 2 hours you come, and there's cake, and there's cookies, and there's tables of four, and there's no agenda other than that whatever comes up is going to be what's talked about.
Wow, that's amazing.
And
for some reason, tables of four makes me smile. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, if you're a conversationalist, it's, you know, table of five leaves somebody out.
That's right.
Table of
that's
two
right.
is got to
be inclusive
bit.
When we're talking yeah. about end of life. Yes.
Well, and there'll be lurkers and silent
yes.
people,
oh,
but
I
there'll
bet.
Be people who've come with an agenda
yep.
and a table of four can manage that a little bit better.
Well, there's a lot of, there's uncertainty. There's, I guess there's a mystery. There's a fear, I suppose, around talking about things of which we don't really know much about, right? Until we've been kind of tossed into it, or, and this is precisely, I guess, why you're an advocate and why you've written The Dwindling and so on, to provide not maybe a manual, but a way forward for others.
Yeah, I think it's, I believe, lots of people believe, but I certainly believe that there is no change that ever happens until the stories start getting told.
Mm, nice.
And the
That's
more
a great,
of us.
Great thought.
Yeah. Tom King said that too. All we are is our stories. But once we are comfortable with telling our story or a piece of it, other people become comfortable with telling their story too. And you can't, the roadmap of how that's going to lead to changing the way Goliath behaves or the way money is spent in the GDP
mm-hmm.
or what the values are, you're not in control of that, but you are in control of sharing your story.
So Janet, tell me a little bit more, and then I want to talk about your husband briefly, but why doesn't change happen until you start telling your story? What is it about that? Why is that such a catalyst for moving society and relationships and life forward?
Well, I think, you know, that a story is a from the heart thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a fact or a statistic or a report is a from the head thing.
Sure.
And I think we pay more attention to the from the heart stuff, which might then drive us to the head stuff to find out more. But the thing about caregiving, just to get back to that a little bit, is there's so much ambiguity in the feelings that a caregiver has.
Right.
They're maybe afraid they would start to cry
sure.
or that they would start to abuse their cared for with anger, or they have doubts that they've done things right, or caregiving is over and they're just so sick of it they want to move on,
right.
or too tired or burned out.
Sure, yep.
The result is you don't tell your story. And the mass of us not talking about it is the, now, I mean, my career was in government, in policy. The
oh,
mass
so
of,
you were a part of Goliath.
Oh, yeah. I understand Goliath really well. because everything that was done to me, I've done to others.
Right. Funny.
But I do know that you need stakeholders speaking up, and the squeaky wheels stakeholders, and they're there too, and they have needs, but who do speak up get attended to a whole lot quicker by this Goliath
right.
with its, you know, sort of hard of hearingness. And so you get more ambulances and more big pharma, you know,
sure.
Designer
sure.
drugs and fewer home care workers that help out the end of life. And palliative care is nowhere. And MAID is wonderful. We're all looking at assisted dying with great glee and bringing it on very fast in the society. But meanwhile, one in three Canadians who needs help in the dying, the palliative care, don't fix me, just keep me comfortable.
Mm.
One in three is going to get it. It's terrible. So that's a silent, invisible army of
right.
people not speaking. And my little voice is to say, tell your story.
Tell your story. No, I couldn't agree with you more. Richard Wagamese, who I'm sure you're familiar with,
mm-hmm.
his phrase is, stories are meant to heal.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we can empathize with others. It's a step in to somebody else.
Right.
There's a shared intimacy there when you actually start to you build on this kind of authentic and transparent way of connecting with others. And I think it's marvelous.
Yeah.
I'm going to read a little bit from chapter 14. Quote, it wasn't exactly a kidnapping. Mom was never a prisoner in River Vista Manor. Still, everyone was appalled at first. My husband had a list of concerns. I wondered if they disguised what I suspected was his underlying problem. Quote, I need you too. What about me? Close quote. I had no answer to give him. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, and maybe it's not in just relation to him, but to your family as a whole, to your sister. How did it, you know, how did it ultimately bring you guys together or push you apart? It must have been, I mean, I know I've had some experience with it, but I know it must have been just a challenge on so many levels.
Yeah. Well, it is a challenge. Good word for it. I mean, my particular husband has got to be the hero of the story, being the most patient person ever. But he had needs too, and I ultimately, you know, was squeezed enough to speak to them.
Right.
But, you know, I couldn't be in Calgary and in the West Coast at the same time.
Sure.
And
yep.
My head had space for one thing and not another. And caregivers everywhere will know what that means because they're pulled in so many different
right.
ways with
right.
kids and whatever. As to siblings, because I come from a family of seven, and in the end, two of us took on the project.
Right.
And it was stressful, and there's anger in that, and some pretty hard conversations. But part of the post caring reflection is, so what are you going to do with that?
Right.
Your parents would just cringe in their graves if they thought that their passing pulled apart the family.
Right.
And you know, siblings don't get to, you know, pick each other, but they have one common cause, and the thing that unites them all is the love for parents, or you know, the relation with parents.
Sure, sure.
So we had a lot of family meetings, and there's a lot of forgiveness that Judy and I had to work through, and there was a lot, not so much as there could have been. I'd recommend more conversations with siblings about, you know, you can't help change the diapers, but could you do the taxes?
Right.
That kind
right.
of thing.
Sure. Play to people's strengths.
Yeah. So most siblings is a big thing. And handling siblings so that you don't get left with an aftertaste of bitterness
right.
is a job that should be happening, you know, inside the caregiving project
right,
as well.
Right. Sadly, we're coming to the end of our time together here online, and but perhaps we're going to have to book a part two because I feel like we barely scratched the surface. Can you tell me a little bit about something that you talked about offline with me, your senior strategy and what you referred to as the edge?
Well, I mean, to what is the edge is, it's not those last 3 days, you know, the die is cast in those last 3 days or weeks or whatever, when you become, as the medical profession says, actively dying.
Mm.
It's the edge. It's when you, the no-go.
Right.
It's the point where you know that you're not going to fix this and you're not going to stop the advanced old age. And what happens then to how you're cared for and how you think about that and what values apply, and we get into ageism and all of the things that we have to fight against. So in my terms, where I really want to be headed now that I've written the book, mm-hmm. is to be a person who tells my story as purely as I can,
right.
and then says, now, you tell yours.
Right.
And so the senior strategy, people will say, so what's the point of that? And the point of that is that there are a lot of things going on that individual citizens with computer skills or not can do to poke the Goliath and the, you know, the government and everything to behave better for an end of life, edge of life.
Right.
And the senior strategy, it isn't a strategy, actually. It's just a framework so far. But if it's to become a strategy, it would be because everybody wrote their MP or okay. responded to something that's in the media. The media is full of stuff which is dreadful. And they've always got comment sections. You can respond or
sure.
you can
yep.
phone in.
Yep.
We have to be active in the ways that we're good at.
You're calling people to act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm saying, don't just sit with this.
Right.
It's like the birthing movement. When we were young boomers having our babies, and you were supposed to have the doctor pull the baby out while you were anesthetized and said, that's not going to work for us. Everybody had to get to work to shift the way we think about
yeah,
birth.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, you know, lots of the doctors working with palliative care would say it's just the other end of the system.
Well, it's, you know, it's the, isn't it a beautiful phrase, that whole cradle to grave? And isn't really what we're talking about here living well? You know, ironically, we're talking about dying in the edge and having some sort of senior strategy in place or silver tsunami, whatever the words are you use for it. It's really about building stronger relationships, about relying on this sense of community and family and leaning on others in a wise way. And that makes sense, and that's what's so—it's so ironic and yet so beautiful about it at the same time. Well, I wish you so well with the book. I've read a few reviews online; they're terrific, and it really is just a beautiful read. And it reads well, and it's an easy read. So I highly recommend it to my listeners, and I hope you guys get out there and pick it up. Now, you have a website too, Janet, don't you?
Yeah.
Is it Journey? Is that it?
It's called Journeys Press, all one word.
Yep.
.ca.
Great.
For Canada here.
Excellent. Journeyspress.ca to find out a little bit more about the book, and you have a blog as well.
Yeah, and it's the way to think about, well, how could you get involved with your story?
Right, right. Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And maybe we can set up a part two in the not-so-distant future.
I'd go for that. There's more to say.
There sure is. Thanks, Janet.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sometimes the transition to fall and winter feels like experiencing every season on the same day. The shoes in the Allbirds Mizzle collection were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Check off your errands with the Wool Runner Mizzle, dash through cold and wet weather with the Wool Dasher Mizzle, or upgrade to next-level protection with the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.